Stanford University School of Medicine, and I'm glad to be here. I've been asked to chair this workshop, and it being a workshop, I hope we can make it fairly informal. Each of the three presenters, myself, Dr. Christensen, and Dr. Schlanger, have brief presentations. I would propose that we have a question or two after each presentation, if there are some, but then have plenty of time for discussion at the end as well. And from my perspective, if you have a question during the talk, feel free to ask it. Ça me donne plaisir d'être ici au Canada et je peux faire mon traduction à la fois. Mais, that'll be the last of my French, but the chef of the Académie Française avait dit, de parler l'anglais c'est une nécessité, de parler français c'est un privilège. Oui, voilà. Voilà. So what I'd like to do is talk very briefly about studying trauma and responses to trauma on the internet, and we have some experience doing that. I'll be talking more about that tomorrow afternoon, so I won't go into much detail about the studies we've done, but I'd like to discuss some of the principles of using the internet in relationship to what we know about the nature of acute and post-traumatic stress disorder and the things that are most effective in treating it. For disclosures, I have an odd disclosure, which is that I consult for the Nissan Technical Center, so that's a highway, not the internet highway, so I don't think there's any conflict. But this is the way we treat distress on the other highway here. So what I'd like to briefly do is discuss the internet as a resource, principles of PTSD treatment, some things we've learned from our study of responses to 9/11 in particular, and implications for the future. And I will go through this very quickly. You've heard some of it in the excellent talks earlier today, but the Pew Foundation, which has studied internet use, has made it clear that now an overwhelming majority of people are on the internet, as you might expect. The 18 to 29 group are more than twice as likely to use the internet as people 65 and older. But as we either get educated or die, clearly the use is increasing. It is higher among higher income people, 94% above 75,000, if there are any of those left in the United States these days, and 57% under 30,000. There are some, but not huge, ethnic differences in the use of the internet, which is interesting. About three quarters of urban and suburban locations have internet access, about two thirds of rural educations. And again, as you might expect, education is a very strong determinant of the use of the internet. And as you heard this morning, health information, 75% of people are now accessing health information on the internet. So it is becoming a primary source of health information, interestingly higher than shopping, news, banking, sports, and mental health, as you heard, is about 22% of the uses, if people use it. One other point that came out of the Pew survey that I think is very salient for some of the social connecting that we've talked about on the internet is that 55% of people in the survey said they felt eager to share their new health or medical knowledge with others. And an e-patient wrote, knowing that you're doing what you can to help others who have come down the path after you and who are as bewildered as you were when you were on that path. And that interactive quality of giving as well as receiving help, which I've seen for decades in support groups for cancer patients, clearly applies very much to the internet as well. And so people solidify their own expertise by immediately turning around, blogging it, or in other ways offering it to other people on the internet. The internet provides vast opportunities for broad population access, which is superior to convenient sampling. There are ways of controlling for biases in the samples that one gets on the internet, like propensity weighting, so that you can adjust for differences in the population you sample. And there are ways of verifying people who access the internet. I won't spend much time on this today. The idea of using the internet to provide information is tremendously important, particularly given the absolutely terrible job that the broadcast media do, particularly when it comes to traumatic events. What they tend to do is show very disturbing images over and over again with virtually no useful information about what to do about it. You can also pinpoint connections of people to specific problems or activities, and I'm going to return to that at the end of my talk. So I think the internet offers vast opportunities for providing rapid, specific information and information that can be linked to action. One of the tragedies after 9/11, and you saw it again after Katrina, when the government couldn't figure out what to do, people were volunteering effort, opportunity, money, whatever, and they had nowhere to go to find out what to do. People would get in trucks in Georgia and drive to New York to try and help at the site, and there was nobody to communicate with them about what they could or couldn't do. So the opportunities to use the internet to connect people, provide person-specific information, and plan action at a time when a community is mobilized to do it is something that we have just barely begun to think about, and I think it provides tremendous opportunities. And the personal networking sites that you've heard about today provide a great opportunity for mutual support as well, and I'll return to that at the end of my comments. So there are five principles of dealing with a stressor, and I want to discuss them and how the internet can potentially help people deal with those. And the acronym that I use to remember it is FACES, and I thought this up before I heard of Facebook. Face rather than flee the stressor, alter your worldview, cope actively, express emotion, and get social support. In terms of facing rather than fleeing, I want to mention briefly that the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences recently wrote a report that I was part of on the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are a few important points. These are the members of the committee. A couple of interesting points, particularly for those of us thinking about using the internet to treat trauma. Number one, very surprisingly, meds didn't work. That although there are some studies that show that serotonin reuptake inhibitors may help with post-traumatic stress symptoms, the overall conclusion was there is not sufficient evidence to show that the antidepressants work, and for sure the anti-anxiety drugs don't work. They're not helpful and they're habituating. So interestingly, pharmacology is not at this point the answer, despite my highway sign a few slides earlier. So of the psychotherapies for PTSD, the one that had the strongest evidence in its favor was exposure-based therapies. And the idea is basically that you have people relive in a controlled setting aspects of their traumatic memories, come to terms with them, gradually desensitize their emotional reaction, cognitively restructure their understanding of the event, deal with the emotions in the context of a supportive relationship. Now, I'm going into a little bit of detail about this because I want to underscore the fact that the difference between cognitive restructuring, coping skills training, even EMDR and others, and exposure-based therapies is not absolute, it's relative. It's how much of what do you do. The evidence is strongest for the exposure-based therapies, but there is evidence supporting these other therapies as well as being effective. The take-home message, and the thing that I think is most important from the point of view of the internet, is that facing rather than fleeing the traumatic memories is therapeutic, it's not anti-therapeutic. You know, there are many people who say, forget it, don't think about it, run away from it, don't deal with it, you therapists are just making these people worse, don't talk with them about it. And the overwhelming evidence is that that is not the case, that finding controlled, sensible ways to revisit traumatic memories is helpful rather than harmful. That's the bottom line conclusion of this report. They recommend, and this is something we can use the internet for, that there be more research on early interventions. And this, again, is where the internet can be tremendously helpful in getting there quickly, much more quickly than you can put other human physical support systems into place. And research on the optimal duration of treatment approaches, which is again something we can do with the internet. Now, I'll mention briefly, and tomorrow I'll be talking in more detail about a study we did on 9/11. Within a couple of weeks, we had a website working. Eventually, we recruited 7,582 people into this study of their reactions to the 9/11 attacks, and we got about 4,000 at a 6-month follow-up. So we were able to look at factors at baseline very close to 9/11 that predicted long-term outcome. And I'll just mention a couple briefly here. One of the factors that predicted, that was associated with distress at baseline was denial. So people who were saying, oh, it's not that bad, it really isn't so terrible, actually were more distressed and had less of a sense of well-being at baseline. So acutely denial doesn't work. Interestingly, another problem, a cognitive problem you see in trauma is self-blame. People tended to blame themselves. I didn't respond properly. I should have done something better. We're more distressed at baseline and at six-month follow-up. Now, I wish our government had more self-blame about what happened because they missed a lot of warnings about what was going to come. The government denied any self-blame, but people who experienced it are in trouble. And that's something, that kind of cognitive misappraisal of the event, which is commonly seen in rape victims and other people who have been through traumatic events, is a major factor in the symptomatology of post-traumatic stress disorder. So facing it rather than fleeing it is a good idea. Changing your worldview is important too. I was sitting on an airplane trying to get my work done, and a very friendly neighbor next door was, of course, reading all my slide files on my computer. Now, normally when they ask me what I do, I say I study schizophrenia, and that usually gets them to shut up. But she saw that I had all these World Trade Center images, and here's what she told me. She said, I worked at 350 Broadway across the street from the World Trade Center. She lost two-thirds of the people in her firm. My life changed. Time became my friend. I gave up a full-time job, lost 50 pounds, spent more time with my children and parents, and am now engaged. I realized that my career wasn't everything. So people who had the cognitive flexibility to use the traumatic event as an opportunity to re-examine their lives and think differently about it wound up doing better. We got a lot of email responses from these participants, and I'll share a few of them with you to give you the idea. Taking this survey, which is just a series of questionnaires, helped me sort out some of my feelings and reactions. I haven't done much about it, but it helps to understand my thoughts and behaviors in reaction to the September 11th attacks. So people found it useful rather than harmful to just sit there and reflect on their own experience and what it meant to them. Another one wrote, I can't believe how timely your email is concerning the 9/11 follow-up. I look forward to participation again. I've been so ultra aware of my own mortality these last months. Now think about those sentences, the last two sentences I read. She's looking forward to participating and she's been ultra aware of her mortality. You would think that wouldn't go together. But people who were faced with this threat found just a series of questionnaires on a website a helpful way for them to face and deal with their own concerns in a controlled setting. Remember that the essence of trauma is helplessness. It isn't fear, it isn't pain, it's not having control over your own body. And so when you revisit these memories in a controlled setting where you're approaching it on your own terms for your own purposes, it starts to transform the meaning of the trauma because you're experiencing it differently, and the internet can be a powerful way of helping people to do that. I look at these images and it seems as if I'm seeing these events unfold for the first time. Funny how one can stand outside of themselves and see a better view. Another thing people did, and just Likert, I never thought of a Likert scale as therapeutic, right? You know, 0 to 5. But you know what? People would look at these scales and say, well, you know, I'm only a 4 on anxiety. There must be people who are 6s. So I must be doing better than other people. Or they would say, I was a 5 6 months ago. I'm only a 2 now. I've improved. So they use even just scales as a kind of social referent that can be helpful. I shed a tear and it felt good. Thanks for your caring. In particular, we found that people who made negative changes in their worldview, who wanted to turn back the clock and make things just the way they were before 9/11, were more distressed at baseline and at follow-up, controlling for the relationship and baseline. The third factor is coping actively. We encourage people to find something they can do about some aspect of the trauma. And you see that time and again. It sort of makes you feel proud. I mean, New Yorkers, who are not known for being the nicest people in the world, and I can say that because I am one, you couldn't walk down the street on that day without somebody offering to help you, give you some food or water or change your clothes or do something that they could do to help you. And that is a powerful adaptive human resource that makes us community creatures, not just a series of individuals. But we did nothing with the internet to help organize that response, and there were plenty of people who wanted to help. So I think that's a tremendous potential opportunity for giving people opportunities for active coping. Just participating helps process the horrors, alleviates the pain and terror for a few moments. Thank you so much. As I realized the six-month marker was coming, I really appreciate this opportunity to set aside time and reflect on the many questions you pose. I feel it is an important part of the healing process for me, and I'm sure many, many others as well. So just seeing it as a task by which they were doing something to help themselves cope with the trauma and by contributing the data to help others was something they found helpful. There's a term in trauma research called speechless horror, and as you can see, these two people watching the World Trade Center covered their mouths, didn't know what to say, and that's not uncommon. They don't know how to deal with the emotions that come. And clearly, expressing emotion is another very important aspect of dealing with trauma response. I tend to keep things bottled up inside. It was a great opportunity to explore how I felt about things. It made me think, and I appreciate that. Again, this is somebody on a website answering a bunch of questions about their emotions. That's it. And our goal in managing distress is to convert anxiety into fear and depression into sadness. Focus the distress in ways that suggest things you can do about the things that are making you feel bad. Or as Shakespeare put it, give sorrow words, the grief that does not speak whispers to our fraught heart and bids it break. We found that people who were higher in emotional control were more distressed, so it doesn't work. The more people try to suppress their emotional reaction, the more distressed they are and the less well-being they feel. And you sometimes can't even see it. These are people exiting the World Trade Center while it's about to collapse. And the only one who really looks distressed is this lady here. The rest of them don't. So it would be easy to miss it because people are trying desperately to control their own emotional reactions at the time of the traumatic event. And we have evidence in some of our group psychotherapy work with cancer patients that we can train people to stop suppressing emotion so much. And that's the yellow line here in a randomized trial. They're less suppressive of emotion. They feel more competent in managing their emotion, even though they suppress it less. And it mediated the reduction in distress that we saw in a randomized trial of having group support for dealing with metastatic breast cancer. So these things actually are effective in helping people control their distress. And we found, there was a question raised earlier today, can we apply these psychotherapeutic tools to the internet? And I initially, as a face-to-face group person for many, many years, was pretty skeptical about it, but we did a trial of a synchronous electronic support group for women with metastatic breast cancer. And what we found was with primary breast cancer, what we found was that this was a surprisingly effective intervention. It worked a lot better than I thought it would. And we found significant reductions in depression scores, the patients reported that they felt significantly better. It wasn't a randomized trial, but the pre-post difference was significant. So we were able to significantly reduce depression on the internet with a much clunkier kind of system using typing rather than visual and audio images than we would use now. So there's considerable evidence, I think, that it can help. And the final thing to keep in mind is social support. I think this image tells it all. This is from 9/11, that there are two emotions here. They're both scared and sad, but they're also very close to one another. And you can't talk people out of their misery, but if you are close with them and support them during it, you will start to modulate the emotion simply because it includes intimacy as well as fear and pain and anxiety. And again, the internet and the many flourishing network sites now that help people make social contact and potentially make emotional contact with one another, including immediately at times of trauma, I think can be tremendously helpful in doing that. And we found that people who had a social network that was characterized by social constraints, where they couldn't talk about their emotion, were actually more distressed, both at baseline and at follow-up, than those that had a more open and supportive social network. So this is, I think, a tremendous opportunity for what the internet can do for us. And I'm going to skip through these slides because we're running out of time and simply say that I think stressors are best handled facing altering worldview, cope actively, express emotion, enhance social support. The internet provides tremendous opportunities for dealing with each of those five areas, I think, in some of the ways we've tried and know about and others that we're just beginning to think about. This is our Center on Stress and Health. Thanks for your attention. Okay, any questions or comments before we... Yes.
Has anyone designed any effective web-based programs that can speak to the kind of requirements you need to treat this effectively? Obviously, you're not going to get as many therapists or live therapists as you're ever going to need for widespread disasters.
Yeah, people are working on it. I don't know of any that directly address these issues, although they may in fact exist. It's really hard. I mean, the interesting thing is that relatively non-interactive programs that give you very little feedback actually seem to be surprisingly helpful. So I would have hope that designing more actively interactive programs that give you feedback about your responses and what they mean ought to be able to work. I know there are people working on them, but I don't know of any examples that I can recommend at this point. I'm hoping that in a year or two that'll change. Okay.